Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the OIS podcast. I'm your host, Sophia Patai. Now, today, I'm thrilled that we can take a leap to the East and discuss things, all things cornea and more, with Professor Jod Mehta. Now, Jod is a renowned ophthalmologist and cornea specialist who's made significant contributions in the field of corneal diseases and transplantation. Over the last 5 years, his work has focused on developing new techniques for corneal transplantation, improving outcomes of corneal surgeries, and advancing regenerative medicine for corneal diseases. He's also been involved in some clinical trials of novel treatments for corneal infections and dry eye syndrome, and has led several international collaborations to improve access to corneal transplantation for patients in developing countries. In addition, Prof. Mehta has published numerous research articles and book chapters and has received several awards and honours for his contributions to ophthalmology and cornea research. So, Prof. Jod Mehta, it's a pleasure to have you here at the podcast and welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Thanks for having us on this today. Thank you.
Now, Prof. Mehta, I know you better as Jod, and that's because we did a lot of our training at some point together in London. But if I look at your titles on your email sign-off, for example, you have about, I'm not kidding, 10 different lines. So I want to understand the journey from Jod, the resident I trained with, to Professor Jod Mehta in Singapore. So take us through that journey and start wherever you like. I know you trained at the University of London, Guy's and St. Thomas's, but would love to hear your career journey and pivot to Singapore.
Yeah, sure. So I started, as you said, so at Guy's and St. Thomas's, where I was a medical student. And then from leaving there, as you know, in ophthalmology is very competitive. I think anywhere in the world is probably one of the most competitive subspecialties to get into. And that first job is really crucial to get a hold into an ophthalmology residency training program. So typically most of people in the UK do neurosurgery. So that's exactly what I did straight after house job. So I actually was a neurosurgical SHO in King's. So King's is quite a famous neurosurgical department in London. And so I worked for a guy, I had a great time. He was a great boss to have. And he wanted me to do neurosurgery residency. And I used to see a lot of patients. He used to specialize in aneurysms. And one day he knew I wanted to do ophthalmology. And one day he said to me, you know, Jod, I think you should do ophthalmology because you're a bit too emotional to do neurosurgery. And I said, okay. And I said, because you get very upset when people die, and obviously neurosurgical patients do die. And, you know, we used to, you know, do brain biopsies and then send patients back for rehabilitation. And he goes, I can see it really affects you. But what he said, what I'll do is I'll put you in the best position to get a SHO in ophthalmology. And that's where all my first publications, I think my first five papers are all in neurosurgical journals. And all my initial papers in research were actually in neurosurgery. So when I went for that first eye job, I had part one of the exam, which happened to be in Birmingham. I turned up for the interview. There were like 25 people in the interview. I had never used a slit lamp, basically, because I was doing neurosurgery. And everyone was like, where are you working? I said, I'm at King's. They were, oh, you're at King's College. And I was like, no, but I'm a neurosurgery SHO, not an ophthalmology. And they were like, okay, this guy's never going to get a job. This is like for a teaching hospital position. And there were three jobs, and I got the third job. And I'd hardly ever used a slit lamp apart from medical school. And when I went for the interview, they said that, you know, well, you know, you can come in. So I started early and I sat in with the senior registrars at that time in that training program. And I learned how to use a slit lamp, and they were very kind to me. And I would sit in there examining, reading about flashing lights, floaters, all these emergency stuff. I was so worried about being on call in Birmingham because it was super busy. And I started basically doing ophthalmology. And then I was commuting from London back and forth for those 6 months. So it was pretty tough. Living because I don't really know anybody in Birmingham at that time. And then a job came up at Moorfields. And then after 6 months, I actually resigned a 3-year rotation job, which sounds pretty crazy for most people. And I took up, I got an SHO job in Birmingham and then in Moorfields. And then when I was at Moorfields at the interview, again, everybody had like 2 years experience and I had like 6 months. And at the interview, I remember them saying, Peter Lieber was at the interview and he said, look, you know, we can teach you how to do phaco, but we can't teach you to write papers and teach you all these other skills that you've already got already. And I got a 2-year rotation basically in London. So, and then I spent 7 years at Moorfields basically after that position.
And you used a few terms there, which folks who are either younger than us or in different parts of the world might not be so familiar with. So SHO is like a junior resident, right?
Yeah.
And so junior registered.
Yeah. So that was the most junior level, basically, right from qualification. I'd just done, you know, your effectively 1 year to get your registration. And that was my first job, was basically in neurosurgery. And then I did basically, I mean, I enjoyed neurosurgery, don't get me wrong. It was actually quite, I actually quite enjoyed it, but it is tough mentally. And, you know, it's not like ophthalmology. But the cranial work was really good. And back in those days, they just started doing interventional radiology at King's. King's was one of the first departments to do that. So it was a really nice unit to work in and things. And I learned a lot doing neuro, which obviously then helps a little bit in eye stuff. But yeah, I didn't want to basically do neuro later on, basically.
And so you made the foray into ophthalmology. And I know you and I passed through the corridors of the Western Eye Hospital in London. Yeah. So you did your training, but then take us through the next steps that then led to your foray to the East.
So then I did my sort of SH registrar jobs, residency, and then basically fellowship in London. And then most people will go abroad for a year. And then, so I spoke to a lot of people, you know, a lot of the more senior guys, where to go to do fellowship training. And, you know, a lot of the guys senior to me, they'd all gone to Australia, right, to do basically training and stuff. But a lot of, you know, I looked around on the internet and I thought, okay, look, you know, see where some, you know, who is doing all the cutting edge kind of research and things. And I looked at, I mean, Japan was a choice as well, but I'd never even been to Asia, to be fair. I'd never been further east from India. And I'd only been to India like three times. So I thought, okay, it's a little bit out for me. And then, so I thought, okay, what about Singapore? And then there was a guy there who was doing who was an overseas fellow doing PhD with Roger Hitchings in glaucoma. So he was from Singapore. And he said, oh, look, John, why don't you come to Singapore? And I said, look, I'd never even been there. You know, people speak English? You know, how am I going to communicate and stuff? And he said, no, you know, you should come and visit and things like that. And then we will then link you up. And then I thought, okay, fine, this is an option. And then I looked in the States as well. But the problem with the States, obviously, for anyone from the UK, is that we'd have to do exams and USMLEs and things like that as well. And I was a bit unkeen about basically having to go through to do exams just to go to do fellowship. So then I thought, okay, this could be an option basically for me and to basically go. And then I came to visit here in 2004 on a sort of a holiday as well to go to Cambodia. And I thought, okay, well, let's, and when I came, I realized, you know, most people speak English and I thought, okay, it's quite a cosmopolitan place here. So I thought, okay, this is an option. And I came here for a year and a half to do fellowship. And now it's been basically 15 years here.
Fantastic. So that's a leap of faith going from not knowing much about Singapore at all to now living there for the last, 15 or 20 years almost. Yeah.
I mean, when I came, I basically had $500. I lived in a youth hostel for like four days because I had nowhere to stay. And then I basically, you know, they have a system here to get housing where you get like, you need an agent, a stay agent to get a house. So I actually went into a hotel and the guys in the hotel were actually so good. They actually said to me, why don't you just stay in this room? And I was like, okay. So then I basically paid the same rate for you buy in a condo, but I actually had in a hotel room. So it was great. And I had to go back to UK for a wedding, I remember, to go to one of my friend's wedding. So I just left all my stuff there and they just let me stay in the hotel. So I stayed there for a month. It was fantastic, paying cheaper rate than most people pay for an apartment, but I was living in a 5-star hotel, which is like quite good, which is quite nice. But
I think Singaporean people are incredibly kind as well. So that probably went up a bit as well. Yeah. So you've talked about all these leaps that you've taken across to this journey really across from one part of the world to the other. And, you know, I'm always one that says, you know, fortune favors the brave. So clearly you managed all the kind of opportunities and you gave yourself the opportunities, but perhaps there were also some challenges along the way. So I would love to know, were there any challenges you faced and, you know, how did you cope? And it's always easy to look back if you could have done it any differently. Yeah. Would you remember, or is this the journey that you never dreamed you'd take, but somehow it's ended this way?
Yeah, so I think there are, and I mean, so but this is back in 2005, 2006. So the first thing is that, so I don't know anybody here. I mean, I knew like nobody on this island at all, like one person I knew and not even that well, but that was it when I came here. And so, you know, you're a little bit apprehensive. And also, you know, coming from having just done fellowship at Moorfields and spent 6 years of my life, people thought I was crazy not to just stay on and just basically, or, you know, they were like, why are you going, you know, why are you going abroad? What, you know, what's the thing from there and stuff. So there were a lot of people saying, you know, why are you doing this? Why? You could easily just, you know, go and do another corneal fellowship or do a refractive fellowship like everybody else has done previously. So there was a little bit of that kind of thing as well. And so that was a little bit of a calculated gamble, to be fair. And then, you know, people used to come here from London and they would tell me, you know, John, if you want to come back, you know, you can come back and do plastics fellowship and come back and do like something else or whatever and stuff and get back into the system. So it was kind of like I always felt like I had a door to basically go back in. The main thing being here was obviously I didn't know anyone. I knew just one person. So you don't have any of that social sort of network at all. People are quite friendly. There is a reasonable, I would say, expat community here as well. Not so many in ophthalmology, but that was something that was sort of developing for overseas doctors, basically in ophthalmology. Most are local, and most of the local doctors all went to college together or university together, so they know each other really well. So you do have this a little bit of an outsider, and obviously I still have a very strong British accent, so it's different to a lot of people will speak here as well. And communication. So my parents were still living in the UK. At that time, I remember setting up Skype on my mother's computer. And I said, look, you know, Mom, this is how Skype works. You press this button and then you can, you know, connect. And at least we could have like some calls on Skype. But, you know, this is 2005. So it wasn't so common to do Zooming or Skype or WhatsApp and all this kind of stuff like we have now. So it was really, you know, starting up. I had to literally set it up on the computer for her so that they would even basically link up. And then, you know, your parents have this concept, to be fair, you know, you're working in like London. Why are you going? Why are you going? My dad thought I was working in the field hospital or something. I don't know what he thought I was doing. And then he would often say, you know, just come back now. Right. You know, you've had your time. Just come back. Yeah. And I was like, no, I work here. This is what we do and stuff. And so there's a little bit of a lack of, I think, concept on their own thinking as well. And then they would always say things, especially with elderly parents, which are quite sort of emotional, kind of like, if you talk about something on the phone, especially my dad, he'd say, we'll talk when you come back, right? And then when I'd go back, then he would say, okay, I'd say goodbye and something, things, and I'll see you next time. And he goes, I might not be here next time. It's like, so you then have to then just, you know, what do you say? I mean, it's like, it's very difficult to say anything back in that situation, but I was flying back and forth practically every sort of 3-4 months. And they live in Devon. So I would then land in Heathrow, go to Paddington, catch a train straight to the west side, and then to West Coast. And I was doing that roughly every 3. And actually, it wasn't so bad. You get used to it. And it was okay. And I thought that it was important to basically do that. And eventually, you know, as things turned out, I actually saw them probably more than my own brother and sister who live in the UK. And I used to see them more. And I used to fly back and forth from here, basically, to do that. And then my mother came out to visit, back to, you know, 2010, is after being here for 2-3 years. So, so you have to make that decision. And I think that also being so far away, you have to make the decision that you're going to try. If I'm just going to stick here and not travel, yeah, I think it would be impossible to live here because you don't have that connection, family connection that you would have had in the UK. And you've got to make a bit more of an effort to travel from there itself. On the other side, my sister lives in India. So I see her way more than I ever saw. I only ever saw her twice in my whole life before moving here. And now I see her, you know, when there's meetings there or something, I'd always go by Delhi. I see her like even before COVID, almost like 3 times a year and stuff and things, or that some of her kids come here. So I see that side of a whole of my sister, my other sister, that I've never seen before and stuff. So that's been really good in the whole like time I've basically been here.
Well, thank you for being so candid about your experience. And I think that really exemplifies, you know, fortune favoring the brave and taking that leap of faith. And I hear you when sometimes our friends who are watching out for us say, what are you doing? Why are you moving? I faced that myself. And just going on to the concept of moving to Singapore, I mean, as you know, I've lived and worked there for a short time myself, and I would love to know what your feelings are about Singapore as a economy, because let's think now, the topic of our podcast is, of course, innovation. When I think about Singapore, it exemplifies innovation. And if I think about the economy, you know, over the last 50 years, I think I just read a stat this morning in a book about semiconductors that I think 7-8% of semiconductors are produced in Singapore. But what I also read in the last year or so is there's a real shift to the biotech sector. So you're immersed at the forefront of ophthalmology and innovation. and with your forays into biotech. So talk to us a little bit more about Singapore as an economy, as and you know what you think its approaches towards biotech.
Yeah, so I think it's changed a lot, even in the short time I've been here, right? So in 10, 15 years, I've seen massive amount of changes. So I can imagine from pictures in the past, from 15, 20 years ago, following from independence, it's changed a huge amount. And I think it's, you know, Singapore really, you know, there's not that many natural resources here, right? So they're quite pragmatic. And the natural resources are the people, right? So the people are the resource.
Right.
And they have a very can-do attitude. And all my fellows that have been here and stuff, you know, they, you know, you'll see, you know, when you speak to Singaporeans or you speak to people and they'll say, if you ask somebody, can you do this? They won't say, yes, I can do it. They'll say, can. So there's this very can.
That's right.
You know, this stuff, right? So they will say can. So they, you know, they'll shorten the word around. And it's a very can, as in can-do attitude. So it's kind of like, this is a problem. And it's kind of like, it's not like, okay, we're not going to be able to do it because of A, B, C, D. It's kind of like saying, okay, can, you can do, we'll do it. Now, how it's going to be done, I'm not sure. But it's that attitude. It's a positive attitude to get it done. And I think there's a realization also from everybody who lives here is that you live on a small island. So being the best in the island is basically not going to be good enough, right? In the real world scale economics and stuff. And so, and again, you got to look at border fields. So you got to look at Asia Pacific, and even you got to look even further at border fields. So I think generally there's a very heavy attitude of punching well above your weight here in many things itself. And I think being a small country surrounded by two, you know, mega countries, China and India, we have to use that to our advantage to be nimble, to be efficient, and to do things. Otherwise, you know, we're never going to be able to compete on a basically on a global scale. And innovation is a way of basically doing that. So innovation going from not only from tech, from basically biotech, but also basically whether it's electronic tech, whether it's water, whether it's environment. So in many areas, I think innovation has to be that broad category itself. And I think that, you know, when you apply it for biotech, I think that, you know, more specifically, even for ophthalmology, but generally for biotech industry here and stuff as well, it's the innovation that's driving, that will drive the research and also drive the way forward itself. And we're relying on the research to basically drive the innovation. So I think those two things actually go basically hand in hand. And that's where I think most people basically settled on. In order to do that, you need to create a very good ecosystem, right? And I think there have been certain things that have been developed over the years. There's lots of lessons that Singapore uses, say, from other countries of the same size, say, Switzerland, Israel as well, number two good examples. Israel has a very, very high level of entrepreneurs and stuff. And now Singapore is using a very similar system to that, or even, you know, I wouldn't say anywhere near as advanced as sort of Silicon Valley with respect to its entrepreneurs and people putting investment, but on those kind of similar kind of models there as well. And I think that as that's basically developed, you will get more and more attraction of basically hedge funds, investments basically coming from outside Asia Pacific to basically Singapore itself. And I think that that's something that's really developed, I would say, probably in the last maybe 5 to 10 years than in the previous years, basically going forwards.
Now, I loved all those themes that you weave together. And I think a few elements really stuck out for me, that about people being the actual natural resource, which I really resonate with. But also you touched upon the point of research driving innovation. So let's dig deeper into your research interests. Now, if I read out your titles, you know, you're the head of the Tissue Engineering and Stem Cell Group at the Singapore Eye Research Institute. You're also head of the corneal service and a senior consultant in refractive surgery at the Singapore National Eye Centre. So how did all these different elements relating to cornea come together? Just talk us through what you're doing and, you know, how you're building out knowledge and sort of skills transfer in this amazing specialty.
So I did corneal fellowship on a clinical side, right, even from when we were in London. And then obviously I did that here as well. And so it was very clear. And I think we were both lucky, obviously, from where we trained, that we were very exposed to research at a relatively young age as well. And you could see that when we were training, that generally, I mean, I know there's always exceptions, but generally all the best clinicians were people who did research. Okay. And we, you know, and that was quite something that was I saw very, very early on and stuff. So it seemed to be logical. The two things go hand in hand. And if you want to be a good clinician, you can understand how your research can basically drive you. A cornea was very interesting because at that time, back in 2006, 2007, it was changing. The field was basically changing and stuff. So we were switching away from full thickness penetrating keratoplasty to more lamellar surgery, where endothelial keratoplasty was really coming a little bit more to fruition. And Warfield's just started back in that time in 2006. So I was taking sort of the cusp of the wave itself. And at the same time, in refractive, femtosecond lasers were coming in to sort of raise out. Now, excimer lasers had dominated in the 90s and stuff as well, but femtosecond lasers were just coming in. So it's almost as if I took two ways in cornea, in endothelial keratoplasty, and in refractive, in femtosecond lasers. Okay, so I sort of like went, had that thing, and then I had the opportunities to really push in that way. So by then being able to master techniques, say for lamellar surgery, I was able to leapfrog many people who are way senior than me, because I could do surgery that they couldn't do, you see, because I learned it during training and stuff. And they, you know, as you know, learning something when you're a lot older is a lot more difficult than learning something when you're a trainee and stuff, because you have somebody else to help you pick up some mistakes. And even the people teaching couldn't do the surgery because it was so new, right? Everything was basically so new. So that allowed you to then leapfrog a lot of people because of the fact I was picking this up very early, and I was able to do it well. So that helped me then basically push this forward. And the same was with the laser story as well. When we had, you know, we had two lasers here that was very, very new back in 2008, 2009, and some femtosecond lasers. So that whole technology was also developing at the same time. So the difficulty of applying research to that is that you were always split. I was always split between refractive for lasers and cornea for transplantation, which means that you then had to run two teams researching both areas. So there's a lot of work to basically do. On the other side, it allowed me then to have a big presence in two fields that are linked together in some way, but in two established areas. And some people will say, you know, if you say, oh, you know, this person who's been to his job, oh, they'll say, oh, he's a really good corneal surgeon. Other people say, oh, he's a really good refractive surgeon. And it's kind of like almost as if you're two different people in whichever hemisphere, you know, people are mixing with, will basically talk to you about and stuff. They know you either as a refractive surgeon, and they don't even know that I do cornea and I'm doing like transplants. It's a completely different mindset. The advantage of that has been then the fact that from a research side, because things were new and developing, I was then able to put the research into the clinical practice. So you're seeing patients in the clinic and think, okay, yeah, these people are doing better. Can I then do some research to basically improve this? And because things were just actually developing at that time itself, there was lots of opportunities to basically do that, both on cornea and research. And then that has really developed. And in cornea, the concept of just changing individual parts of the eye or the cornea itself for transplant has really come to the forefront now with what we've been doing over the last basically decade. And now we're taking that to a completely like level of a cellular level where we're changing individual cells right now, where we can change epithelium, stroma, endothelium now, and then maybe stroma in the future. So it's really gone to a cellular level. And then of course, you can then stack your research with your clinical work, right? Which is fantastic, because then you develop a nice cohort of basically patients. On the laser side, it's the same. Femtosecond lasers now, you know, they're to a pet. Everybody knows about femtosecond lasers, but I've been to meetings 10 years ago and people would say, oh, you know, they know better than a microkeratome. Why don't you just use a blade? Why are you using this fancy $400,000 laser and stuff? But now it's developed so much, they're like mainstay for treatment. And now you can do unbelievably exciting stuff with these lasers that are available now, where you can do stuff that you just couldn't do. Basically, you just can't even do manually. You need, the lasers are really helping you. And that's where I see the laser pushing what you can do technology wise or to the patients. That is just like unbelievable that you can't do basically with conventional surgery.
So it sounds like you were really lucky, but also opportunistic to ride two waves of innovation, as it were. And it sounds as well that you're able to integrate your research into your clinical practice, which is so wonderful. But tell us more about, you know, you touched upon the leapfrogging of colleagues who, you know, hadn't maybe had a chance to kind of gain those skills, because we were lucky enough to be in an environment where, you know, you and I could get an excellent training. So how are you paying that forward now with your trainees, and how are you building out sort of training and sort of dissemination of skills for these, you know, highly personalized techniques?
Yeah, so that's one of the limitations with a lot of the complicated surgery, is that how do you then pass this on? You know, how can you disseminate this to more people? Because at the end of the day, you know, you have to be realistic in the fact that if I do 100, 150 transplants a year, and then you multiply it over a 20-year career, that's still going to be less than 5,000 patients that are going to be able to operate on, right? But in real terms, we're talking about millions of people that need this kind of surgery, right? So the numbers have to, you know, there has to be a way that you can basically be able to do this. So, I mean, you know, teaching courses, of course, are basically important, going to give lectures abroad. I mean, I give a lot of talks every year. Before COVID, I was almost giving like about 65 talks a year and stuff. Wow. So lecturing, teaching, you know, obviously going to places, and it's a lot of effort. I mean, I saw this from people I work with over here previously in Singapore, and it's a lot of effort getting into planes, flying to like Brazil, flying to South America, operating, you know, giving lectures. I mean, you meet a lot of people, and it's very funny when you meet people, they have almost the same problems as everyone else around the world, you know, with politics, with seniors, with people stopping the trainees from operating. I mean, mm-hmm. I hear the same story everywhere. And it's like, yeah. It's quite interesting when you hear that and stuff. And, you know, people, but the other thing you do see is that also you see enterprise. People are keen. They want to learn. They're desperate to basically learn. And when they get somebody from overseas coming, they're really, really keen about trying to learn as much as possible. So I think that I was told by someone like years ago that, you know, if you're ever in an opportunity where you're really good at something, it's really your responsibility to teach people. And, you know, you can criticize, you know, bad surgery and stuff, and everyone, you know, of course you can do that. But instead of criticizing, you know, we're in a lucky situation with our facilities here. And so therefore we have to basically take the opportunity to go and teach people. You know, if you can't criticize and then say, okay, you know, it's because they've had lack of teaching. Not everybody's going to be so fortunate to have a good teaching program. And I think that by doing that, it's a massive advantage. Of course, we have fellows and, you know, we don't, I mean, I've had like 30 fellows like in about 12 years, and it was not a massive number of people. But the point is that, of course, they go back to their own country. So, yeah. For example, I've seen that where I had one fellow from Mexico. He sent his fellow to me as well. Also, I trained his boss. I trained this fellow as well. Then they're going back. And then, you know, just the other day, he sent me an email saying, you know, John, I did my first DMEC and stuff. And it's great. I mean, I'm never going to be able to fly to Mexico to do a DMEC, right? It's just not going to happen. It's so far for me to get there. But, you know, he's doing it from what he learned. And then he said, I just want to thank you and stuff. And I send them videos, send them things itself. And we had a fellow from Pakistan, you know, he's done a tremendous job since he went back. They have very high rates of keratoconus. And he went back and he's doing, and all the patients there are all getting dogs now instead of penetrating keratoplasty. And it's a huge, huge effect from him going back there. And, you know, when he was here, he struggled because of the pace of the work. And he really, you know, struggled to get a grip to things. But, you know, he's gone back now and really started off from scratch. And he's doing now in a practice that was doing 100% PK. Now they're doing about maybe 60% lamellas or 50% lamellas, which is a massive effect. And that, I feel, is kind of like paying back a little bit to the system. And, you know, it's kind of like disseminating some level of skill that people are getting opportunity to getting some surgery instead of getting in a plane, flying to Singapore. Obviously, you know, that select few, you know, percentage of people who are going to be able to do that and as well. So in that way, I think that's basically helping. Now, obviously, there's lots of stuff on YouTube videos. The problem with this stuff on YouTube and things like that is that you're only seeing a small amount of surgery, right? So, you know, I'll show some complicated surgery and I'll show a 30-second clip. And people say to me, actually, John, that doesn't look too difficult. And I said, sure. You're seeing basically 30 seconds of a 3-hour operation, right? And so you know, we during COVID, we used to get our fellows to on Zoom sit and watch a whole operation, right? A whole dog or a whole 2.5-hour surgery, because really for them to understand that actually this is not easy. And many times during the surgery, you change your mind or you may try something else, something hasn't worked or something has worked. And then you will change the way you basically do the surgery. And also to understand, you've got to sit in that chair for 2.5 hours and not move and concentrate. And a lot of people cannot do that, right? And because they get fed up. It's like going for a 21K run, right? A lot of people can't do it because it's 21K of running in a straight line, which is notoriously boring for a lot of people. But it's being able to train yourself. You know, and I think you don't have to do surgery to it. You can do other sport, you can do other activities. It's a mental training. So can I sit still for 2.5 hours and do this and stuff? And people, a lot of our fellows, you say to me that, John, most people would have just given up by now, right? And it's just a case of like, yeah, I'm not saying I'm not tired at the end of the surgery, I am, but 3 hours of operating, you know, okay, this, you're going to get through this and stuff, because you've trained yourself mentally and physically to be able to do this. And I think that's important, especially considering cataract surgery is very fast nowadays, and we don't put ourselves in those situations of stress at that level for a long period of time.
Now, I love those pearls about thinking about wellness and alertness and being able to sit and concentrate for that period of time. I dare say not many of us could do that in reality nowadays. And so thank you for sharing these wonderful pearls about dissemination of skills. But let me ask you now, you know, it's April 2023. What do you think about the metaverse as a mode for teaching and training? And of course, I have to bring up generative AI and ChatGPT. So how do you think these two modalities might influence the training of not even tomorrow, but training right now?
Yeah, so I think metaverse is interesting. I mean, I like the concept of integrating training with virtual reality and also augmented reality, right? Mm-hmm. And we see that, you know, already now, like with our microscopes, and you know, we Leica have a plant here, so I do a lot of work with Leica with their new generation microscopes, right? And they're trying to change a lot of their ophthalmic microscopes now into just heads up displays with VR basic technology. So you know, you can do a cataract procedure, and I can have the lens coming up in my heads up display. I have it on my OCT that I currently basically use in OT and stuff, so I can see OCT real time imaging while I'm doing the surgery right now. The issue is that, of course, these things cost a lot of money and stuff. They cost more. Hopefully the price will basically come down. I think it will integrate into research, and I think it will allow people to practice and try to basically improve things. But what has to be done by us, as in the doctors or the community basically, or the users, is that we have to provide the evidence that these things are better, right? And that falls basically on us. The companies and the tech and things, I think they will develop stuff, and I think they have to work with so they're the neighbors to develop the technology stuff, but I think they have to also speak to the surgeons, say, look, this is what we want, and this is what's the disadvantage. And also I realize when you see a lot of tech is that they may speak to a certain group of surgeons, say one country, and working in Asia, and you know, where most of our population are basically Chinese in Singapore, you know, you see that when I also operate on eyes in the UK, it's very different anatomy. The anatomy is different. The AC depths are different. Yeah. You operate on an Indian person, it's completely different than operating on a Chinese person, and the anatomies are all different and stuff. And if you do not get all that input when you're developing something, you're never really going to be able to make that tool completely universal. It will work in a certain population of the world. And you've got to bear in mind almost two-thirds of the population, or a third of the population of the world, lives in Asia, right? So you've got a massive population of Chinese and Indians here. Chinese market is a booming market, say for refractive, for example. And I think that you've got to take that into consideration when you're developing new devices, new instrumentation, or even basically from a teaching aspect, that everything is not that perfectly deep anterior chamber depth of 3.2, 3.4 that I used to see in the UK, right? So, you know, I see crazy levels of myopia here, like minus 10, minus 12. Our average is minus 6 that comes through the door. In the UK, it was minus 3. So you've got to take these things into consideration when we're developing things on in the metaverse. But I think metaverse will be a great advance for teaching. Where I don't think it's good is for conferences. So I still think that one thing I learned through Zoom, I mean, Zooming has been great for certain webinars, and we had no choice during COVID. But there is that loss of personal touch of actually meeting somebody face to face. And I think the people who were in webinars through Zoom, and I did quite a few as well, they were already people who were quite established in their field, because people just wanted the names of the people there to come into the webinar. What they didn't do was take a gamble on the young, because they didn't know the young people. That's why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel that there's lack of opportunity there for younger people to break through, to give lectures, things like that, in a Zoom system. And that would worry me in a metaverse when you're organizing meetings in that way, because you haven't got that personal touch where you get to meet somebody and then you get to talk to them and then really find out a little bit more about that individual and think, okay, fine, maybe, you know, it'd be good to get them to come and stuff. And then people always want to take safe bets and they just go with the named person or the more famous professor or whatever, because they think, okay, that people will come and listen. So that's what would worry me in that way.
And what about generative AI? Are you worried that your residents might be secretly looking at their phones and when you ask them for 10 courses of X, Y, and Z, or how's that going to look?
So I think two things on this. I mean, we had a recent discussion on ChatGPT, basically in medical healthcare, and like, you know, would doctors be worried about people using it to make their own diagnosis as well and stuff? But so I think everybody wants patients to be more informed than they are and ask questions, right? Even any doctor who doesn't want that is basically going to get into trouble somewhere along their career. And I think asking more questions is better than asking less questions. And actually, I worry more about people who don't ask questions, because you worry they have unrealistic expectations. So if they're more informed from ChatGPT, telling them the questions to basically ask or whatever, I think that's actually a great thing itself. They have to understand, though, that ChatGPT is not going to replace the doctor. They're going to basically give you an idea or concept. So there has to be that realization on the patient side. So you're still going to have to see somebody. You can't put in, these are my symptoms, like people do in Google, and then it comes up with a whole list of basic diagnoses and stuff. Right? So I think that's important from a patient's understanding for basically how it works. But, you know, we recently used, so I'm organizing the subspecialty day at the Academy this year. You know, it's actually called Refractive GPT 2023. That's the title of
it. Okay.
Right? Sure. And, you know, I just put in titles into just to see what would come up on the current version of GPT, not GPT-4, but the current one. And it was amazing, actually, what topics came up and what I'd already made a list of stuff that we were going to discuss or we were going to talk about. And it was amazingly quite close. So, and I think that, you know, using AI, and I saw, you know, with there was a lady from Microsoft, one of the regional heads was basically there. She showed how you can use ChatGPT to help you with like Microsoft PowerPoint presentations and even Excel spreadsheets, drawing out different pictures, and even getting to a level where you can have the same data, sending it to two different departments, and the interpretation of the data with what graphs were shown were basically going to be different. So that sort of thing is really, I mean, I think it's quite interesting. And I think that we have to embrace it in a level where, definitely for healthcare, we need to see where it's going to be useful for, right? And what areas in medicine, with radiology, it's going to be augmented. And I think it's only going to help people. Right? I mean, the idea is that, you know, people have this fear, is it going to take my job away, right? Am I going to be replaced by a robot, or am I going to be replaced by, you know, a computer and stuff? Instead, I don't think it's going to basically happen. But what it's going to do is probably make as medical professionals, we have to realize that there is a standard, right? There's a big standard. Everybody knows this, right? Maybe people don't want to talk about it, and we all may have medical degrees, but clearly there is a variation in standard. And I think that using AI or some of these basically regenerative based models may actually increase the overall standard, not in Singapore, not in Asia Pacific, around the whole world. Yeah. That you can basically increase the level by using some of these kind of softwares. And I think if that happens, that alone will probably save many people's lives, because we're all operating at a slightly higher level.
Now, I agree with you fully that we need to embrace these new ways of thinking and training. And so just on the note of training, you know, we have a lot of the audience who are younger folks who are embarking upon their careers, maybe in ophthalmology, or even maybe going into cornea as a specialty. So just as we round out this podcast, you know, what, apart from being able to sit still for 2.5 hours, what other advice do you have to those trainees who want to maybe follow in your footsteps?
I would do the thing that you enjoy. Right, the most, because there are lots of, sure, it's really nice giving big lectures and name lectures and winning like prizes and stuff and things as well. And then many times along the way, your papers won't get accepted, they'll get rejected, you have to fill in the reviewers' comments, and you're having to stay up night analyzing data, and the animal results don't work, and the machine didn't bloody work, and this didn't work and stuff and things as well, right? And at the end of the day, with all those ups and downs, is that if you enjoy it and you really enjoy what you're doing, then you're going to basically be okay with basically taking the negatives and stuff. So enjoy the peaks. I wouldn't get too down on all the troughs, because there will be many along the way itself. And, you know, and if you really enjoy it, you will actually find it a lot easier basically to apply yourself, whether it's in cornea, whether it's in retina, whether it's in any field, basically within ophthalmology and really any field inside medicine. I think if you really enjoy it itself, then actually you will find that you will find something innovative in that area. I mean, obviously, we're kind of like sold, because we're both ophthalmologists, so we're kind of like, we'd sell ophthalmology. I think as a field in medicine to go to, I think ophthalmology is the most exciting field, hands down, mainly because we're one of the few fields that uses innovation right at the forefront. And if you look at many technologies, whether you talk about gene therapy all the way basically up to AI, even stem cell therapy stuff, ophthalmology has really led the way forward in that area. And because of the fact, obviously, we're dealing with a small tissue, a small organ in the body, an important organ, right? I mean, you know, people value their eyesight tremendously, right? Whether it's basically, you know, if you disable, you lose an arm or something like that, obviously has a huge effect, but you lose your vision, my God, it really significantly affects somebody's quality of life. So you have an opportunity to really affect somebody's quality of life, quality of vision. And so people are living longer. So you have a much more higher aging population. So of course, with some of the surgeries that we do, you can have a really massive effect on somebody's life. So I think ophthalmology is a fantastic area to go into. And we synergize between technological innovation development and clinical really well, probably better than any other field, I think, in medicine. And there's been lots of innovations, even in our lifetime, in the last 10 years, right? You wouldn't believe, you know what, you know, and there was a guy I just saw now. I did a transplant on him four weeks ago in the morning clinic and stuff. His vision 6.9 corrected with a pair of spectacles. I mean, that would be unheard of 10 years ago to get that. And I told my fellow, you know, even in the best PK at 9 months, you wouldn't get this result. And this is with a one dot up to seal with a pair of spectacles. He's basically 6.9 and stuff, right? And I think that that's only going to be pushing the level forward. And I think that it's an exciting area to go into. And I would encourage people to basically go into that field.
Well, I'm sure, you know, folks who are listening or watching are now had the goosebump feeling where they just feel so energized and enthusiastic, because you've really energized me about ophthalmology right now. So John, thank you so much. I think we've learned a lot. If I can say, I think you're a startup of your own. You started up from a neurosurgery and then took your own initiative to really build out a very successful career in Singapore, from knowing maybe one person to you being known very much in Singapore as Professor Jodh Mehta. So Jodh, thank you very much for your time on the OIS podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks, Sylvia. Thank you.